9.5 minutes after 8, let's look at WGTD Sports and Weather just ahead of the morning show. The NBA, the Bucks and Bulls were both off last night. The Bucks are off again tonight. The Bulls play the Raptors in Toronto. NFL Thursday Night Football, Buffalo plays in Miami. Coming up on Sunday, the Packers host Philadelphia at Lambeau. That was originally a noon start. It's been flexed. It's a 3:30 game on Sunday. The Bears will host the Vikings in a noon start on Sunday. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Thursday, November 13th. Cloudy and breezy, scattered snow showers, high today 33. Normal high this time of year, 47. Tonight a cold one, low of 19. Friday, partly sunny and 30. Here are the numbers right now, brand new ones just in. Wind is from the west at 13, now 25 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. 23 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill stands at 14. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News time, approaching 8:11. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and today is the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council, and Nan Calvert is with us in the studios with a very special guest that she has brought along, and I know we are going to have quite an interesting hour with Dan Lyons, who wears one of several different hats as the relatively new Director of Education at beautiful Hawthorne Hollow, but is also an adjunct professor of physics and astronomy at Carthage and an adjunct instructor of mathematics here at Gateway Technical College. So as something of a juggler myself of various roles, I already feel this close affinity to Dan Lyons. And he has all kinds of exciting things in mind and already underway at Hawthorne Hollow, and we're going to be mostly talking about that, but about a lot of other things as well. We welcome both of you to the morning show. Nan, tell us about this invitation that you extended. How did you first come to know Dan Lyons?
Well, it was great, good luck, and also our wonderful friend Rick Fair. Good morning, Rick. I know you're listening out there, who gave me the heads up and said, you know, Dan would be a very interesting person to have on the show. And so then I immediately contacted Dan, and he said yes, and here we are, and I think we could do about 10 hours with Dan, but unfortunately we only get an hour, so... Have at it.
Absolutely. So it's good to have you here. In fact, you said you've been on actually on the morning show, I think, a long time ago, right?
No, not the morning show. I think I remember you interviewing me as a student at Carthage a number of years ago, and I recognized your interview style. so I was kind of excited to come
there
and be
you
on
go.
The show
well,
you.
Good to have you here. So let's get the biography out of the way first. From here in Kenosha, tell us
from
her
Kenosha,
story.
Born in Kenosha, lived here the first 21 years. I did my undergrad at Carthage College. I was a physics major there, and I was bound and determined to go out to go to graduate school and become a physicist, particularly interested in astronomy, astrophysics, and made my way to the Southwest, where most of the astronomers on Earth live, or at least the highest density.
Right, where the skies are really clear.
Absolutely. Dry air, mountains coming up out of the desert and nowhere, big perches for people to put telescopes on. And eventually got into a program at New Mexico Tech, so it's short for New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, in a little town 70 miles or so south of Albuquerque, New Mexico. That's Socorro, New Mexico. And they do radio astrophysics there. So they run the VLA, which is now the EVLA. So in astronomy, there's lots of acronyms. So VLA is Very Large Array. EVLA is Extended Very Large Array. And it's a radio telescope. It's an array. It was 27 antennas. I'm not sure what they're up to now, if they've added any. But to extend it, they've sort of changed the back end. And what that means is, so the back end of a telescope is where the cameras go. You've got kind of two big parts. You've got the part that collects the light and then the camera on the back of the instrumentation. But with radio, it's not a camera. They've got horns and waveguides, and they've got a whole compiler, much like the electronics you use for broadcasting radio. It's sort of that in reverse, but for looking into deep space. After that, I got involved with Tim Slater, who was at University of Arizona at the time. That's where I originally met him. But he was moving because he had been hired as the endowed chair of science education at University of Wyoming. And I had been trying to work for him for a PhD program. And when time came around, I was graduating from New Mexico Tech. He said, "Well, Dan, you want to go to Wyoming?" And I said, "Where?" Okay. And I had learned in that time who you work for really counts. And so I went with him, and I did a PhD program in physics and astronomy education. So that's where the education side really started to come in. I had found in my master's program I had a certain talent for communicating the complex physics ideas to the undergrad students in a way that my peers, they were okay, but the story was it seemed like my students were sort of bringing their friends who were in other sections of the class to my office hours because they had such success kind of working with me, I guess, is what they had done. So I
well,
was
that's
sort of
certainly a rare gift to take something that's really complicated and boil it down in a simpler fashion without distorting it or oversimplifying it. So that's a rare and valuable gift.
So. Part of that, so that's a major piece of the science communication to the general public, but part of it from a one-on-one when you're working with a student has to be figuring out what their mental model of the abstract idea is at the time. So what exactly are they thinking about? How are they thinking about it? And I think part of the piece of what I was doing was just taking the time to figure out how they were thinking about it, and then I could address them where they were at. I think that's 90% of the battle. So it's sort of two pieces, like you said, being able to boil it down without distorting it or losing the essence of it, but also from a tutoring or instructor perspective, just taking the time to figure out how your students are thinking about something, because everybody's experience is different coming in, and they're all at different levels. So there's no one silver bullet that you can just have this perfect way of describing something that's somehow going to reach everybody in the same way. You can get about halfway there for most people with a general thing, but at some point, you got to figure out how people are thinking about stuff.
Mm. And that has been a real serious course of exploration for you, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, professionally. Tell us more about that.
So beyond, just briefly, because I could go on for a long time about that, after graduating at University of Wyoming, I moved to a postdoc position doing research in a cognitive science department, so the psychology department at University of Chicago. And my boss there, Sion Bylock, who is now in the provost's office in addition to running her lab at University of Chicago, was partnered with a physics professor at DePaul University, so sort of on the north side of Chicago. And what we were working on was something called embodied cognition theory in physics learning. And what we would do is go into the physics classroom, and we would look at how certain labs would have hands-on components and develop research methods to go into the classroom and actually tease out the differences in learning between those students who had a hands-on experience, a physical, we call it embodied experience, where they get sensory motor feedback from a system to learn what these abstract equations mean. So we were looking at torque, you know, torque equals I alpha. Well, the moment of inertia, or I omega, the angular velocity. So you have these Greek letters, you have freshman students taking this class because it's part of some requirement, and in general, they want to memorize it and figure out what to do with it, but they can't really apply it. But we find that for some reason, the students who have the actual hands-on experience are better able to apply the knowledge, better able to use the abstract equations when they're quizzed and then later tested. So it's not sort of an ironclad conclusion, but it is telling us that the sensory motor experience does change and affect the way you think. So again, like you were saying, trying to understand how your students are thinking is a big part of being able to communicate and really get an authentic learning experience where it's more meaningful because they take more away from it. It's sort of tailored to them.
And I think what you're saying here is that that is true of just about everybody.
So some people will say, like with the hands-on learner, I'm a hands-on learner. Well, there aren't categories as far as we know. This brain mechanism is in everyone's brain. It's the sensory motor system located on the sides of your brain and the parietal lobes. So this is, to a certain extent, for everyone. There may be individual differences, but everyone has this part of the brain, unless you were, you know, something had happened where part of your brain was missing. So it's not that there are categories where someone is in fact a hands-on learner and they should learn this way, and someone isn't and they should learn that way. This is something that we would presume that would benefit everyone. That there basically everyone should get some experience interacting with these things, or you know, like say in the physics class, getting their hands on things and interacting with it. If this is the case, if this is, you know, and the evidence so far suggests that this is what is going on, that it physically feeling, getting sensory motor feedback from changing the parameters of a physical system, in fact, does enhance your performance later on. It changes the way you think in a positive way.
And so you were studying that mechanism, trying to figure out exactly what's going on or why that is true or how that's true.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly.
Fascinating stuff. And that isn't the worst of segues in terms of some of what you're doing now, although I don't know if, in terms of your timeline, if that brings us all the way to Hawthorne Hollow.
So I spent 3 years at University of Chicago, and as exciting as that was, I was eager to sort of get out from behind a computer screen. The reason why I had originally launched into the education side, doing the physics and astronomy education to begin with in Wyoming, was that I really enjoyed teaching. I had really positive experiences with my students. It didn't really matter how big the class size was. I got a lot of positive feedback from them, even in the 3 years in Wyoming, seeing students later on, you know, out and around the town. They would be excited to see me, sort of tell me how they were inspired. And these are, you know, when I was teaching astronomy in Wyoming, these are non-majors. And so they weren't physics majors being inspired to go on to physics, although that would be great. These are people who were marketing majors and English majors and finance majors who they went into astronomy because they thought, you know, oh, cool, astronomy, that'll be great. And I'd see them 2 years later, and they'd stop me and grab me by the shoulder and say, your class was the best. Learning, you know, and I'd say, come on, there are other good teachers. But they had such an overwhelmingly positive experience. I think in the context, this is my guess, in the context of any number of other science classes that they didn't have. So they'd self-selected out of science. They were in something that was kind of really far away from science in their undergraduate studies. And I think that they had such a positive experience, they kind of saw the light and said, wow, science isn't all boring. It can be inspiring. And that's what made me want to go forward into the education side and get back to interacting with people. So when the director of Hawthorne Hollow said he wanted to expand and sort of create a new position to coordinate the educational programming and to develop it further, I said, well, I'm in. If you get the position, I'd really love to come up and do that. Interestingly, Hawthorne Hollow, I had worked there before as sort of a groundskeeper. Summer, you know, cutting the grass, fixing lawn mowers, trimming trees, mulching trails. It was my summer job in high school and while I was an undergrad at Carthage. Huh. So I'd worked there for a number of years just seasonally, and it was always a place when I'd come back home to visit home in Kenosha, I'd always visit out there. And just to see how much it had grown over the years since it was gone was exciting. And to then come back and be a part of that and really bring whatever talent I may have to try to really improve the place and have it improve what the offerings are. I mean, the place itself is amazing, and the offerings right now are amazing. But just to get more sort of more regularized so that people know about it and know how to take advantage of the sanctuary. It's a bit of a different place than a park. I mean, we have Petrifying Springs across the street. But I can't tell you how many new people every year, every summer come out, and they're from Kenosha or Racine, and they say, I never knew this was here. And it's right in our backyard. It's 20 minutes from the middle of Kenosha and the middle of Racine. You know, we serve, let alone the people in the county. So there's a lot of people who can take advantage of it, but, you know, how do we preserve it, keep it quaint, keep it, have the same feel, but then also offer things that are unique to the place? And that's really sort of part of what the mission is to preserve that.
For those of you just joining us, along with Dan Calvert, we're speaking today on the morning show with Dan Lyons, who is the new director of education at Hawthorne Hollow. As Dan mentioned earlier, Dan actually grew up in Kenosha and just now was relating how he once upon a time actually worked on the grounds of Hawthorne Hollow. So this is something of a homecoming in a couple of different ways. Now, growing up, were you the kind of kid, of course, you probably grew up before there were computers at home, so you wouldn't have been sitting in front of a screen. But I mean, does this, if we'd known you as a young boy or junior high or high school, would we have pictured you at a place like Hawthorne Hollow?
Oh, it's possible. We didn't have a computer in the house till I was a junior in high school, when I sort of said, Dad, we really need a computer because everyone else has computers and I need to get one because we need to do this. So it was dial-up internet, which I'm glad that doesn't exist anymore. Well, maybe it does exist, but I'm glad I never have to interact with it.
Right.
My dad was a gardener and a carpenter, and we had a garden every year of my life. And, you know, my love of trees and plants had really probably come from that. But also he'd brought me to work with him, learning how to use tools. And this is where sort of how things work and how I can fix things and learn, understand how to take things apart and put them back together. That really was something that had inspired me once I got to college in the physics and astronomy world to think about, sort of remember I was talking about the back end of telescopes, the cameras, the spectrographs, the things that go on the back end that allow you to measure different things. I was really interested in building those kinds of things, and that's some of the work that I had done. But in the meantime, what that relates to at Hawthorne is that I can be really versatile, and that's really important because all of the people on staff, which are essentially three people, and then there's the director, Joe. There's Lori Ardiomo, who's our it's a restoration ecology position, and then we have our grounds curator, T.J. Levesque. We all have different specialties, and we all sort of do all different parts of the job. I don't do only education stuff. That is sort of my bag, and I go out and do that. And Lori is doing woodland management, and she's restoring our remnant prairie, but she doesn't do only those things. We all get out when it's time, and we have to all participate in whatever the major thing going on is. I mean, this happens in the most extreme way in March when we do our maple syruping program, where luckily there's not much else going on except watching the snow melt. But for an entire month, once it's above freezing during the day and below freezing at night, we're collecting sap to make maple syrup, and everybody's doing that all day, every day. And we have field trip programs, so the kids come out Tuesdays and Thursdays, morning and afternoon. We have them come out, and they learn the ins and outs of making maple syrup. But everybody's contributing to that. So because of that, if the lawnmower breaks, I can go help fix it because I have the capacity with tools beyond what somebody who's only ever really been in front of screens would have. So I think that's really helped me to be a person who would fit in there. But certainly going back, it's always been, a number of things as opposed to, I've never been focused enough on one thing to only be involved in that. I've always had an interest in kind of doing more than one thing, and certainly making things and growing things is a big part of that.
Sounds like this is a match made in heaven for you to be at Hawthorne Hollow and part of this particular staff. The history of Hawthorne Hollow is really, really interesting, but I also suspect that it's a history that a lot of people don't know much about or may have once upon a time heard and not remember these extraordinary two sisters from whom so much
it's
of this
Ruth
all
and
spreads.
Margaret. They're really interesting. So Hawthorne Hollow is where it is because these two school teachers who are from Racine they had gone out, and I think they had enjoyed the area, and they saw this for sale sign where the land was. It used to be the Ozans, and you can go back in the development, the 1850s and 60s and 90s maps of Summers, and you can see this Ozan family is one of the old Summers families, and part of this land, or the land that Hawthorne Hollow was on, is part of that. And I think the sisters, they saw this sign, and they went out, and they purchased this land as their sort of camping getaway. So they wanted to get away, way out into the county from the hustle and bustle of the big city of Racine. And this is years ago, I don't know if it's 1930s. I don't know when it was purchased. I know that they made Hawthorne Hollow in the 60s, so I should get my dates straight on that. But the original piece was they had built what we now have as the amphitheater. And for those of you who've been to Hawthorne Hollow, you know the amphitheater. You may have gotten married there. You may have been on a field trip there. You may have come to one of our summer concerts there or seen it in the art fair. But where that amphitheater is was the first place they actually would go camping. If you remember, if you've been there, there's two fireplaces. And these are the fireplaces. One of them is sort of an outdoor oven grill, and one of them is just a fireplace along this little cobblestone wall, like the big sort of boulders put together. And that's what they put in, and they would go camping down there. And as they got older, they wanted to spend more time out there, so they built what is now our nature center, which used to be an old horse stable. So they built a horse stable for their horses, and they had someone keeping the horses out there. And eventually they built the house, so the residence that's there, and that's where they lived. They retired and moved out there, and they spent the rest of their time at Hawthorne sort of keeping the place. And then they joined with, I think, H. Chris Hyslop to sort of turn it into a nature sanctuary. So it will be preserved indefinitely. I don't know the legalisms involved with land, but whatever it is you do to make it so that, this isn't going to be a parking lot or row houses, this is now a nature sanctuary. But the sisters, We're very meticulous with record keeping. What's interesting is we have these archives where you can go back and look and you can find out, you know, among other things, you know, how much was spent on curtains in 1962 in the spring when they redid the, you know, to the cent, which everyone is tickled by. And it's really amazing. But other things that are sort of interesting about the landscape, you have a decade's worth of records for what plants were blooming, what flowers were blooming in the spring, where they were blooming on the property, for an extended period of time, these records were kept. And one of the things that I'm interested in doing as part of sort of the education program with our local history and heritage and then the environmental science side, maybe partnering with students, ecology students from UW Parkside. We were talking to Dr. Wolf, Joy Wolf, who's over there. He's sort of a ecological geographer. And what I'm curious is to see how those records match up with, if somebody were to study, essentially keep similar records, follow it through for a few springs, maybe it would take more than one student coming through, but find out what flowers are blooming where and match them up to Ruth and Margaret's records to see maybe how it's changed in the last 60 years and if it has. My suspicion is it has, although our arboretum and woodland zones haven't changed, the ecology of the plants there has evolved over the past years. So I'm curious to see what would happen, but we wouldn't have that if it weren't for the characteristics of these two school teachers who had done this.
I was just thinking about how similar that story is to the story of Sinow Conservancy, because in a sense, we have two women, Dr. Elvira Sinow and Dr. Shirley Peterson, who set their lands aside for the same purpose, for conservation in perpetuity. And we have very detailed handwritten records, the phenology record from Dr. Sinow, on a daily basis, what was happening for years and years and years. So certainly our region is rich in the history of women doing conservation before maybe it was even defined as conservation.
And thinking about the details and keeping track of them. And it's fun to think about the ways in which that could be viewed at, not just as kind of a curiosity, but you could really draw some data from it and make some comparisons.
That's the hope. The records she kept are that accurate. Now, keeping in mind that, you know, she wasn't necessarily a trained botanist, I mean, just the meticulousness of the records, as a scientist coming in, you'd have to make some judgments, but certainly I would imagine that they're reliable enough to find out if it's different from what it is now. You can identify what they're... So it's in the same way that historians go through primary documents, they have to make a judgment and interpret, okay, is this person talking about what's here? Is it what's going on? And they sort of have to make a judgment. And compared to the rest of the record keeping that they have, I mean, certainly I think it's reliable enough to possibly do some real science with it. I'm not expert enough in that discipline to know what the right research questions to ask are, but I know that it would be interesting to find out if in the last 60 years or 50 years the plant life, the particularly the native wildflowers, have changed to any degree that would, you know, could correlate with how the maple trees have been sort of taking over our woodland, and we're doing management to restore that. So the amount of sunlight in the woodland areas has changed, and we know those things.
Or is the timetable changing drastically in terms of the bluebells used to bloom in such and such a month, and now they're blooming later or blooming earlier?
Absolutely. Is spring coming earlier or later? I mean, from year to year, if we base it on last year, winter lasted forever. But, you know, 2 years ago, March, it was 80 degrees. All of a sudden, you know. In general, over a long period of time, that's something that I think, that question in particular is something I think we could find out. We sort of have a unique record in a place that really hasn't been developed in a way that other you're not going to find that locally anywhere else. Although, I mean, if you do, let us know. I'm interested to find out where it is.
I want to ask you about a couple of things you've just kind of mentioned in passing. One of them is you at some point made reference to a remnant prairie. at Hawthorne Hollow. What exactly are you referring to, and what exactly does that term mean?
So when we say remnant prairie, we sort of mean never pasture, never plowed. So I'd like to think that the last time it wasn't prairie was when there was a glacier on top of it. But as far as the records go, it was never turned into farmland. It was never plowed under. It was never turned into an orchard, and it was never pasture for grazing animals. So it's a really small piece of prairie. These little remnant pieces are sort of all around. There's another piece just to the north of us, just to the north of A, that's it's actually larger than ours, but we think was part of the same original piece of prairie. So if you've been to Hawthorne Hollow before, when you come up out of the woods on the west side toward the historic buildings, you'll see the restored prairie, and that the sisters actually had as an orchard at one point. So that's what we call restored. But the remnant prairie, again, the last time it wasn't prairie likely was when there was ice on top of it.
Wow. So it is utterly pristine, I mean, or as much as something like that can be.
Well, this is interesting. We're actually restoring it because it's not what you'd imagine. What it is people interacting with the environment. Essentially, farmers coming in, and there's nothing wrong with farmers coming in, particularly because we need food. But in general, when you're farming land, you sort of don't want a bunch of flood puddles everywhere if you've got wetland. So you'll change the grade and you'll irrigate. And when you have farmland, you generally don't like wildfires to burn your farmland down. So you'll change the land so that you don't have what normally would occur coming through. So what had happened over the years is a lot of trees, particularly black walnut trees, they're very precocious. They've got this drop-and-roll method to their seed dispersal where the black walnuts, they like to grow around here, and they'll grow up. And once you get trees growing up, initially you might have savanna, which is interspersed trees. But once you get enough canopy, you start to go to a woodland. And what you lose is the grass's ability to keep sort of like the prairie plants and grasses, the leafy plants, the undercover, to keep the sort of invasive species like buckthorn from taking over. So if you were there 5 years ago, there were lots of trees, kind of all different kinds, many black walnuts, some hawthorn trees were still up there, but a lot of buckthorn, which is invasive, and very thickety, a lot of buckthorn and dogwood. Now, certain kinds of dogwood are not non-native, but they are very hardy. But you wouldn't see as many wildflowers. It was sort of an overgrown prairie. And what Lori Ardiomo has done in the past few years has really said, if we want to restore this, we got to get rid of the trees. We got grant money to get tree services in and really take a bulk of the trees out. We've had volunteer days where they'll help us clear trees and remove brush. We have volunteers usually every Thursday. We have volunteers who come out, and when it's time, they'll go up. She basically is what we say fighting the seed bank, where you know, there's only so many of us, and you can't do it all at once, and you don't want to because you don't want to trample all the plants, but if there's an invasive species or something that somebody could be people just brought when they settled, things that look pretty, there's certain kinds of daisies that are just not supposed to be there. And they're ornamental, they're gorgeous, but they spread and they choke out other things. So when it's time for them to go to seed, then it's time to jump on it. So you want to pull those beforehand. So all throughout the year, there's this progression of sort of fighting the seed bank that's built up. And in the course of 3 years, it's gone from what looked very overgrown to you walk up there now and it looks like a prairie. It looks pristine now. If you go up, I mean, it's in the fall. There's still some seeds, and we're starting to get the snow flurries. But next spring, by Mother's Day, it's going to be gorgeous. I really can't wait. It takes a lot of work. But once you get the trees out, and the trees wouldn't have been there because if you'd had wildfires, certain trees don't withstand it. And I think the black walnuts would be one of those because they're fast growing. And the young trees, if you have a wildfire often enough, is going to suppress those. If you have the undergrowth, it's going to sustain itself. It's that people actually came in and changed the nature of the landscape. And that's what allowed the overgrowth to happen. So it's actually interesting what the story is behind that. I mean, just understanding our impact on the land just by, I mean, not even really developing it, but just farming and changing the way water flows.
Absolutely. I mean, in a sense, you know, when you describe this as land that had never been plowed or never been directly used, there was no, in a sense, direct impact, except that there was, I mean, inadvertent impact by the people who've lived around this. So.
What's amazing is that, you know, we say fighting the seed bank. We're talking about the seed bank of the invasive species. There is a seed bank of all of the native species that were there that are right there and ready to go, which is why it rejuvenates so quickly once you give it the sunlight and open air that a prairie needs. So quite quickly, these things, the seeds are there, and they come back, and, you know, if you give it a chance, the prairie is there.
You're speaking Nan Calvert's language here, of course. I mean,
quite
music
to my ears.
Have you seen this prairie yourself?
A number of years ago, it was about 3 years ago, we had taken a field trip to Hawthorne Hollow during their really fantastic art fair, and we sort of wandered off trail, if you will.
And sometimes you got to do that.
You have to do that.
Watch out for poison ivy.
Yeah. So, you know, like any place that endeavors to preserve our natural heritage in terms of our native plant communities, we're all always fighting the same things. We're always fighting invasive species, whether it's garlic mustard or buckthorn or teasel or any of those things. It really takes a concerted effort. But if you have people who understand the process and understand the long-term goal, you can have great success with it.
Hmm.
And clearly at Hawthorne Hollow, as well as other places, they definitely understand
it. Yeah, we wouldn't, I mean, without our volunteers, I don't know where we'd be, especially garlic mustard in the spring. For some reason, I don't know if people enjoy it or they just enjoy being angry at garlic mustard, but there are areas where 3 years later it just isn't there.
Right.
Now, you'll find them, and we go through, and anytime we find them, we remove them, but there are areas in the woodlands, and particularly where the Pike River goes through, that's the hollow area, sort of the river floodplain, that's sort of where Hawthorne Hollow got its name. This is where garlic mustard will just, it just takes over, and it takes 5 years of diligent effort to remove the plants because of that seed bank that's built up.
And there's great research going on right now, very exciting stuff coming out about garlic mustard and how it can be outcompeted, biocontrols, and all manner of things. So I think people enjoy pulling garlic mustard because it's easy. You can really have an immediate effect on it, and you can stand
and
up
the
and
roots
go, yay!
Come out, and you get lots of piles of it. Yeah,
by the way,
we pull it. No.
By the way, is it good for anything?
It is.
You can eat it.
Okay, so you can make mustard from it or
garlic. You can make pesto.
Yeah, let's not think kindly toward it.
Okay, all right. We'll nip that in the bud. Dan Lyon, something else you said earlier in the interview is worth talking about, and that is the fact that among just the general beauty of what we see at Hawthorne Hollow is also the fact that there is a portion of an old Indian trail on the property, something which was, in a sense, discovered by archaeologists some years ago.
Yeah, so this was tagged as the Indian Trail. So there was this trail there, and we think the sisters, I'm trying to use my memory to recall, I'm pretty sure the sisters had sort of marked this as the old Indian Trail. And talking with Dan Joyce, who's the director at Kenosha Public Museum, he says, well, these trails kind of all over have been tagged, you know, you never know if they are or not. Well, a number of years ago they did a dig up on this trail that was named the Old Indian Trail, and they actually found the depression where the trail was. So he thinks this is a spur of one of the trails that sort of eventually became it's the U.S. Road, essentially what became Green Bay Road. Now, recently he's come out, and we're interested in the possibility next season of doing another set of digs, and they do sort of sample digs. I'm actually going to learn. It's going to be a workshop. So if you're interested in trying your hand at archaeology, keep this in mind and look around in the paper. But we're going to be doing a dig. We're not going to be looking for artifacts. It's not a location. We're looking for a road. So he thinks that this wasn't the main piece of the trail that eventually became the road, because it was only about, you know, a full arm's breadth wide, maybe like three people walking side to side. And what eventually became the larger road, as you know, eventually became a plank road and eventually the highway, they would have had wagons, carts, oxen, and this road would have been at least 12, maybe 15 feet wide. But he's pretty sure based on, he seems confident that based on the documentation that he's found and the descriptions that somewhere through the property, this road goes, the larger road. So next season we actually want to have, we're going to be hosting the dig. There'll be Dan Joyce will be coordinating it. And if they get lucky, I mean, it's best guess, really, if you don't want to dig up everything. And so there are certain spots where they're looking, and we'll actually be offering it as a workshop. It'll be basically a weekend. Either in the spring or fall, we haven't quite decided yet, where people can come out and learn what's going on with an archaeological dig like this. I'm actually kind of excited. But because of that, we have sort of an interesting partnership has developed. Sort of one of the things we want to do with our field trip programs, we want to develop a Potawatomi Jambo Trail field trip for the late part of the school year, sort of May to June, maybe 6 weeks long we'd run it. And this one would particularly focus on the Potawatomi and the use of the land and the history of this trail. But throughout the year, one of the field trips offered at Kenosha Public Museum is the people of the woodland, or the woodlands, where they go through the Ice Age exhibit and end with the trading post. I think it's the Skunk Grove Trading Post with the Potawatomi people, which were essentially the people that were here until the Chicago Treaty, I think 1830. I need a historian to correct my actual years, but this is where they lived, and certainly this is a trail they used. What we'd like to do is something I think is fairly unique. Now, this may be somewhere, but I think it's unique to the area, and we're partnering on developing what we're calling this sort of modular extension field trip. So teachers in the area could register for a field trip with us independently. They could register for a field trip with the museum independently, but if we get the two coordinated, we would also offer, say, hey, if you're interested in this, do you want to start at the Kenosha Museum? Or if they start with the Kenosha Public Museum, and they would offer, do you want to extend your trip to Hawthorne Hollow, or vice versa, whichever order. So you sort of have, you know, the formal, the museum education experience, and then you get on a bus, and there's a 20-minute ride where you actually go out to the field, and you interact with the physical thing that you were, sort of get that hands-on experience, get your hands dirty experience. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is really develop something that will complement each other. It's in the very beginning stages. We basically are at the stage where we're going to try to develop this. And in a couple of years, we're hoping to have something that is really a unique program that is something that Kenosha has to offer that maybe, say, you know, you can't get in a big city like Chicago or, you know, a larger city like Milwaukee. I was mentioning to you earlier when we were talking about this. I grew up in Kenosha going to the big museums, going to Milwaukee Public Museum, going to the Field Museum, and just being awestruck at the scale and inspired by just how much cool stuff was in them. And, you know, I always thought of Kenosha as this really small town growing up in between the two. Well, after having lived in New Mexico in a town of 8,000 and then in Wyoming in a town of 30,000, I was like, Kenosha's not so small. Mm. But to have the rural area, to have the parks, and to have the nature sanctuary, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes from really anywhere in town, that goes for Kenosha and Racine, we've got something in our own backyard that lets us to develop this type of two-part field trip that you can't get in Chicago. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just when you're downtown at the museum campus in Chicago, you're not 20 minutes from anything with trees that have been there for any appreciable amount of time.
Absolutely.
So it's a different thing. And we have something unique to offer, you know, being Hawthorne Hollow and having the sisters who decided to preserve that land, but also in the close proximity with the local museum. It's sort of a different experience that we're hoping will be that we can really be proud of, as a, you know, thinking of Kenosha as a smaller town, even though We're not quite as, I mean, what are we, fifth or fourth or fifth largest in Wisconsin?
Something like that.
You know, we're in there. But
no,
so it's something that we can offer here that you can't get in the big city, and we want to take advantage of that, you know?
I think it's a fantastic idea, and it's also an example of one more partnership, and partnerships are always a good idea in this day and age, and it's really exciting to think about what other things might spring out of it. If people want more information about what's going on at Hawthorne Hollow, various classes and other events going on, does Hawthorne have a website?
Yes, it's hawthornehollow.org, so www.hawthornehollow.org. There's no E in Hawthorne, like the name. I think that's the most common misspelling. So it's all one word. It's just hawthornhollow.org. If you're interested in classes, under the education tab, we've got classes. Our final adult education course of the season is actually this Saturday. And who you mentioned earlier, Rick Fair of the Kenosha Racine Audubon Society, he's teaching a winter birding class. So not all the birds fly south. Some of them stick around and winter it out with us. And he'll be talking about the different types of adaptations they have that let them really survive in the winter in this area, and also how to attract them to your yard. And in the spirit of some of the other classes we put together this year, the Heritage Series, want to get a hands-on piece. We've designed sort of a winter bird feeder kit, so we'll be putting those together. So as part of the fee for the course, you get to put your own feeder together, bring it home with you, and that'll be happening at Saturday. On Saturday, you can register online. You can give us a call. 880, or our number is 262-552-8196, and you can register for that class just by calling us up. You can register online, or you can email me, just dan@hawthornehollow.org, and say you want to register for Winter Birds with Rick Fair, and we'll reserve a spot for you.
Wonderful. Dan Lyons, it's been great to reconnect and great to hear about all of the exciting things going on at Hawthorne Hollow. What a beautiful gem right in our own backyards, whether we're in Kenosha or Racine. It's right there for people to enjoy, and it's a beautiful place. My wife and I used to rent a property directly to the south of it, and Hawthorne Hollow was a place we visited many times and came to really cherish. And so we hope a lot of people who have not ever sought out Hawthorne Hollow and its quiet beauty will seek it out. And we hope you have continue to have a wonderful time there, and best wishes with all the teaching you do as well.
Thanks, Greg.
So
thank
good
you,
to
Nan,
you
for inviting me out.
You're welcome.
I'm glad she did. Nan, tell us about anything else going on we need to know
we
about.
We have events, as Dan mentioned, the Winter Birding with Rick Fair on November 15th, 10 a.m. Saturday, Hawthorne Hollow. Rick will be presenting again on November 18th at Wilmot High School, W-I-L-M-O-T, there's no N in it, 6:30. On November 15th, again, there's a lot happening this weekend at Siena Center. This is an event sponsored by the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center and held at Siena Retreat Center. It will be Native American spirituality with Donna and Ben Yahola. The cost is $35, and that includes lunch. Sierra Club Southeast Gateway Group, November 20th at Gateway Technical College, Kenosha Campus. The title of the program will be Global Sustainability, Comparing Thailand to the United States. Professor Kate Galogli will endeavor to answer the question, how can we operationalize sustainability when the idea is so diffuse and diverse? That will be a really fascinating topic. Mm. Kate's a great speaker. Then,
sustainability being diffuse, yeah, that's
a and diverse, yes. Sunday, December 7th from 10 until 3 p.m. at Sino KRLT Conservancy, there will be a paper arts workshop, and hearkening back to what we talked about at the beginning of the program, this is a completely hands-on experience. Mm-hmm. You'll learn the basics not only of papermaking but of constructing simple papermaking equipment that everybody can do in their own homes. The cost is $45. It includes lunch and all of the things that you'd like to make. Registration is required, though, and you can do so by calling 262-539-3222. That number again, 539-3222. And that's it.
Wonderful. Great things going on. And Nan Calvert, we look forward to you being back in December.
I will be here.
And bring some warm weather with you if you can.
I like snow. Oh. I'm bringing snow.
Oh, okay. Well, no thanks. But thank you, Nan Calvert.
You're
and
welcome.
Again, Dan Lyons, great to have you
thanks,
here.
Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to tell you about a wonderful concert coming up Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church, presented by a chamber group called Rook. They're based in Chicago, and they specialize in music of the 16th and 17th centuries. And